Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Marissa Silver made her fiction debut in The New Yorker when she was featured in the inaugural debut fiction issue. Winner of the O. Henry Prize, her fiction has been published in The Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Prize Stories, and other anthologies. Her collection, Babe in Paradise, was named a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and was also a Los Angeles Times Best Book of the Year. And her novel, The God of War, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Marissa's new novel, Mary Coyne, uses Dorothea Lange's iconic migrant mother photograph as the inspiration for a stunning portrait of the subject, the photographer, and the remarkable legacy which that image continues to hold three quarters of a century later. We're delighted that we can welcome Marissa Silver to the Tattered Cover this evening to present Mary Coyne. Would you please join me now in making her feel welcome?
Thank you so much for that great introduction. I'm so happy to be here. I was just saying that this is a bookstore renowned among authors. They all love to come here, and this is my first time here, so I'm really, really happy to be here. As was mentioned, this is a fictionalization of the story of both the photographer, Dorothea Lange, and the subject. So it is really an imagined kind of fantasia on top of those facts. I'm going to read to you three different sections. Sometimes it's hard to read from a novel because, you know, you can't get the whole flow of it in a short reading. So I guess what I always recommend to audiences is that you read rather than listen for plot. You're listening to sort of the texture of the language, the texture of the words, a sense of what the writing in the book is like. So I'm going. The book is structured in three different stories that recur. One is the story of the photographer who is called in the book Vera Dare. The other is the story of the subject of the photograph who I've called Mary Coyne. And the third is a modern day subject. Now, I'm a modern-day character named Walker Dodge, who is a professor of social history, who, through his work and through certain things that are happening in his own personal life, finds his way towards a connection to these two women that he didn't know existed before. But for tonight's purposes, I'm just going to read you sections from the women's points of view. I'm going to start at the beginning of each woman's story. So this is how Mary's story begins, and it takes place. And I learned how to pronounce this yesterday in Oklahoma, and I had been doing it wrong all along. Tahlequah, Oklahoma. I did it right. It's in 1920. She's 16 years old at this time. Her mother told her that she looked at people too hard. "It's like you're a robber trying to break inside a person's skin," Doris said, as she threw a ball of dough against the table and attacked it with her big hands and the strength of her broad shoulders. "It makes you strange." "I'm not strange," Mary said, although she liked the idea that she might come to possess Toby unawares simply by the power of her gaze. She watched him in the next field over, guiding the horse and plow through the rows, the dirt turning dark as he passed, as if he were pulling a blanket over the raw earth. She watched him hoist bales of hay, wondering how his rattle-boned frame could counter the weight of the dried grasses. Toby Coyne, that sickly boy, as all the mothers referred to him for years, shaking their heads sadly, as if already committing him to a collective memory. He'd managed to outwit all expectation just by staying alive, beating back whooping cough and measles and scarlet fever, so that he became a miracle boy as well. Mary saw how people looked at him in town, their eyes narrowing as if they didn't trust that he was quite human. His cheeks were sunken below their bones, and Mary sat in church and thought about tracing those sharp ridges with her fingers and then her tongue. As the preacher exhorted the congregants sitting shoulder to shoulder on the hard wooden benches to believe against the odds of bad planting seasons and poorer harvests, telling them they should feel special for having been chosen by God to withstand his insults, she felt something reach down to the deepest part of her, as if a hand were touching her there, the way she sometimes touched herself at night holding her breath, careful not to wake Betsy and Louise, who lay next to her, or her brothers who slept on the other side of the house's single room. All that land, acres of chocolate dirt and golden lashes of wheat, the blue Cookson Hills tangled with trees and networks of undergrowth, and the distant Ozarks, which seemed to Mary a mountain range big enough to cover the world. Yet in their churches and houses, in their schools, and even in their beds, people were always huddled in a bunch as if they had to mass together against the threat of too much freedom. Doris gathered the flattened yellow disc into a ball and pounded it with the meat of her fist. "You do this 3 times," she said, "3, not 2. "Should I write that down?" Mary said. "Don't be smart." "That's not likely." Mary knew how to read and write, and Mrs. Pettit told her she was the best at sums in the whole class. But when Mary turned 16, her mother pulled her out of school. As far as Doris was concerned, Mary knew nothing of any real use. "Someone will shoot you for looking at them that hard, or worse," Doris muttered. What worse? But Mary knew the answer. She could tell that her mother sensed something moist and wanting in Mary's parted lips. "You trying to catch flies?" she'd say when the two of them walked through town. Mary was narrow-hipped with barely a chest, but it was something else about her that caught men's attention, a sultry drag to her gait, as if she were waiting for someone to step into her path and make her change direction. Her mother was right. She looked hard at the men who walked into the last house which sat on the edge of town, far enough from the stores and saloon, the hotel and the 2 churches that it resembled a child excluded from a schoolyard game. Men entered through the doorway, their shoulders bent low, as if they were expecting some unseen hand to yank them away from their sinful intention. She watched those same men when they came out again, too, their mouths as soft as bruised pears, their awareness adjusting to their sudden exposure. She watched the boys she'd known at school, too. They were nearly men now, a state of almost which made what they had been and what they were becoming tantalizingly present at the very same time. The being of a thing was most powerful when it was seconds from extinction. A flower about to drop from its stem, a shot rabbit twitching its last. She studied the way those boys walked down the street, their inward turning toes lending their movements the same lumbering intensity of a baby just learning to walk. But it was Toby Coyne who drew her eyes the most, as if he were one of the trick cartoons in the newspaper where a woman's hat was actually a bird, or a white man had one Chinaman eye. The fact of Toby's survival in the face of lifelong weakness suggested a persistence she craved more than she desired the obvious strengths of the other boys who would start wrestling with one another at a moment's notice, as if they couldn't think what else to do with all that fire inside them. Toby was like a spindly tree that had miraculously outlasted a tornado, left stripped and bare of leaves but still standing, while houses and barns lay in ruins. So that's the beginning of Mary's story. And then, many pages later, we are introduced to Vera Dare. And her story begins in 1920 in San Francisco, California, when she is 20. And I guess what you find out a little bit later, but I'm going to tell you now because I'm not going to read that part, is that Vera suffered from childhood polio. And so she walks with a really pronounced limp. San Francisco, California, 1920. It was a costume party to celebrate, well, no one really knew what was being celebrated. The loose collection of artists and poets and self-styled arbiters of taste Vera had befriended since moving to the city often seemed to spend more time playing than working, the parties themselves being a form of tableau vivant. Vera was meant to wear something outrageous. She knew one man who was coming as an orangutan, pink buttocks and all. But what she decided at the last moment was that she would dress like the society women she had begun to photograph in her studio on Sutter Street. These ladies were much derided by Vera's crowd as boringly conventional and corrupted by wealth, but they were the lifeblood of her work, and she was frankly mesmerized by the ease with which they moved through their lives. There was always a chauffeur-driven car following slowly behind them as they shopped in case they became too tired to walk. Tea in silver pots stood at the ready should they need refreshment. If it began to rain, an umbrella would suddenly appear, held aloft by a maid. Vera was devoted to these women because they paid for her photographic services and recommended her to their friends and provided her with a living enough to rent a studio and to eat out at a cafe on Saturday nights if she stuck to home-cooked boiled onions and beef on weekdays. But there was something ineffable about them that captured her beyond her economic pragmatism. Even the ones who had long noses or large foreheads held themselves as though these were the very attributes that defined elegance. The women knew they were rare prizes, and Vera had created a career of sorts, taking photographs to prove them right. It would be interesting to try on that entitlement, at least for an evening. Vera borrowed a dress from Mimi Vandermeer, the daughter of a railroad manufacturer. A young woman besotted with all things artistic, Mimi was delighted when her photographer came up with the marvelous idea of dressing like her. Her merriment, a sure signal that she knew Vera would never pull off such a transformation. My photographer. Vera's clients often used the possessive, my driver, my girl at Gump's, as if Vera were one of a retinue, and in fact, she supposed she was. She stood in front of the mirror in the attic room she rented on Gough Street. The black velvet dress fell into a dangerous V down her back. The material gathered in loose folds over her chest and then again at her hips, ending mid-calf. It was the fashion of the day that Vera generally avoided, not because she was prudish, but because she did not like to show her bum leg. But tonight, she would be brave. Her limp could enhance the costume. It would lend her the air of insouciance she admired in her coterie of friends who walked down the street as if they had just been pulled from bed. Mimi had also lent her a string of false pearls, which Vera arranged as a choker with the extra length dangling down her back. When she moved, the pearls tapped against her spine like a man searching fingers, a sensation that kept her focused on her purpose. She wanted sex. She was 20 years old, new to San Francisco, and her inexperience made her feel alone among people for whom sex was casual currency. Her little skirmish in New York, Bremer fondling her while she painted photographs in his uptown studio, staining lips and bluing eyes, had been enough to convince her that her withered leg did not make her hideous to a man in need. But Bremer was old, his kisses dry and craven. Even if she had been willing, he hadn't had the courage to do more than reach underneath her blouse while she rubbed her hips against him. Their encounter ended abruptly, with him slinking back into the studio, his hands covering the stain on the front of his trousers. She reconsidered the party. It was foolish to think she could hide in an elegant outfit when her history was as plain as her plain face and was apparent to anyone the moment they saw her take a step. She could summon the exact details of her illness and its aftermath as if it had all just happened yesterday and not 13 years before, when she was Vera Dewar, a 7-year-old in Hoboken, New Jersey. She'd woken in the center of the night, feeling like she was balanced perfectly between dreaming and wakefulness. Her brother Leon was asleep in the bed next to hers. She could hear his adenoidal breathing, the slurp and effort of it. There was another person in the room, too, a dark shape by the closet door. She was not frightened, the way she was when she had nightmares about kidnappers, only curious that a stranger should be standing near her closet, as if he wanted something to wear. She had always known there was a shadow world of ghosts and goblins and witches, known that life was made of things you could see and things which you couldn't, like your thoughts or the wind. These ideas often absorbed her, and Miss Hilt had sent a note home saying that if Vera didn't learn to pay attention, she would have to repeat the second grade. Her mother had given her a stinging potch on the fanny and said, "Dreams were for sleep, period. Das Ende der Geschichte, the end of the story." "Shh, shh," her mother insisted, shaking Vera by the shoulders. She put her lips to Vera's forehead. "She's burning up," she cried, and then she was screaming in German the way she did whenever she argued with Vera's father about why he was home so late and why he had forgotten to bring the fish she asked for, and then Leon woke up and started crying. Next, Vera was in her father's arms as he ran down the stairs of the apartment building. He wore only his nightshirt, even though it was winter, and she worried that maybe someone would see his thin, hairy legs and would laugh at him. Everything was odd and wrong and painful at the same moment, to be awakened at night when she had school the next day, to be visited by a ghost who wanted her dresses, to be sweating even though it was such a cold January that her mother had bought her a new pair of boots lined with lamb's wool, which cost too much, and her mother did not want to hear about it if Vera's toes started to push against the front of the boots before the winter was out, because money did not grow on trees. And now her father was running down the street with her in his arms, wearing his white nightshirt, which had once risen up when he reached for something on a high kitchen shelf and she had caught a glimpse of his pink, wormy thing. The ward was full, but the nurses kept the curtains pulled around each bed so that Vera could not see the other children. She tried not to be frightened by their cries or by the angry-sounding bells or the fast patter of feet in the hallway as they drew close, a signal that something was terribly wrong. Maybe terribly wrong with her. Nurses came in and went, their bright, serious eyes glittering like her mother's jet necklace. Some were funny, their worn-out jokes blurry beneath their hygiene masks. "Why will you never starve in a desert? Because you can always eat the sand which is there." She would smile and laugh, though it hurt to do those things. It hurt to eat and sometimes to breathe. Occasionally, a nurse would sit in the chair by Vera's bed and complain about her sore feet or about her useless husband while she glanced worriedly over her shoulder because she would admit with a wink and a whisper she was playing hooky. Each morning, white-coated doctors drew aside the curtain around Vera's bed with a terrible whoosh, stared at her wordlessly, then turned toward one another and nodded while they muttered under their breath like the flock of albino pigeons with their pink blind eyes that pecked at the concrete of the schoolyard. When the nurses bathed and dressed her, Vera felt like someone was peeling off her skin. When she cried, the ladies would say, "Now, now," or warn her not to disturb the other children. "There's no use you polios being in hospital," Nurse Peg said 2 weeks after Vera had been admitted. "There's nothing we can do for you." Peg was the fattest and meanest of the nurses. She never played hooky and never told jokes. She changed Vera's sheets while Vera was still in bed because it took less time that way, even though being rolled back and forth was so painful that Vera had to stuff the corner of her pillow into her mouth so that she would not scream. Nasty as she was, though, Nurse Peg had a lovely way of talking, like the Irish who cleaned the gutters outside Vera's building on Washington Street, calling back and forth to the firemen at the station house in their spongy accents. "Will my leg work again?" Vera asked. "If you're lucky. But for sure you'll be lame, so," Peg said, as she stripped Vera's bed out from under her, the faster to make it up for the next patient. As she fussed and huffed, her wool stockings rubbed against each other. "Shh, shh," like Vera's mother, trying to hush the polio away as if it were an irritating child. Lame. It was a sweet word, buoyant, like a runaway kite rising at an angle in the sky. As Vera waited for her father to come and collect her, she thought of the illustrations in the Pied Piper of Hamelin that showed children marching after the man in his ragged cloth. One little boy followed at a distance, slowed by a dragging leg, his crutch made of a split branch tucked under his arm. "For sure you'll be lame, so." I'm going to read you one last short passage. Obviously, these two women grow up. Each has a very different path to follow in her life. Mary becomes, among other things, a migrant farmer. Vera becomes a photographer and joins up with the WPA project and begins to photograph the migrant farmers in California. And they have a single meeting in their life, which is a sort of pivotal moment for both of them. And this is just a moment when we're with Vera again when she's quite old and she's actually at the end of her life. And she gets out of bed one night and looks at the photograph, the famous photograph that has in many ways defined her life. She searched for the photo. She never liked to display her work around the house. There was something unseemly about doing such a thing, like leaving your drying brassiere hanging on the shower rod for guests to see. She finally found it in the living room among a group of framed pictures stacked against a wall. As she brushed the dust off the glass with the sleeve of her nightgown, she remembered how excited Miller and Philip became whenever she and Everett would pull into a filling station on the long trips to and from Taos. The boys stopped fighting while they watched the attendant scrape away road dust and bird droppings from the windshield with his rubber-edged tool. She could still picture their amazed expressions as they saw a more sharply brilliant world reveal itself through the windshield. That was the thing about looking through frames. You saw something you had seen before, maybe hundreds of times, but you noticed it differently. She set the picture against the wall and sat opposite it. The photograph embarrassed her. It was not that she didn't think it was a good image. It was. She had made plenty of poor ones in her career, and she knew the difference. She'd found the right distance between herself and her subject this time. She'd gotten just close enough to the woman and her children so that she had not forced a point of view by being too aggressive an angle or by including ironic juxtapositions. The picture had been effective because every single person who looked at it had to decide whose side he was on. But over time, it had been so reproduced, so co-opted, so burdened with the obligation to represent an entire era that it had become something both more and less than the image that she had taken that day. It reminded her of an over-decorated soldier who looks less like a hero and more like a little boy playing dress-up. Sometimes when she came across the image in a book or an article, she averted her eyes. Like the woman in the picture. Why did she suddenly, at that last moment, turn her gaze away from the camera? Often people Vera photographed asked her how she wanted them to look or stand. Should they comb their hair or put on another dress? She told them they should do whatever made them feel comfortable. As much as she liked a photo that captured some unconscious moment, she also appreciated the formality of a pose. Maybe this was the effect of all her years working in the studio. People talked about the truth as being something you had to steal when the subject was unaware. The phrase was, after all, taking a picture. But the truth was as much in the way a woman arranged her hair or rubbed a stain off her child's chin before allowing the picture to be taken. The truth was often a performance of an idea of truth. Why did the woman look away? The question was vexing. Maybe she had lost her nerve, and this turning away was a willful disappearance, the way a child covers his eyes and believes no one can see him. Perhaps she thought Vera pitied her. Vera hoped this wasn't the case. Pity was a horrible thing. Where was the father? Oh, yes, she remembered. He was gone. Repairing the car. She wondered if she would have photographed the family had he been there. Maybe it had been his absence that attracted her. A family minus a father was an unbalanced proposition that the eye always wanted to correct. Perhaps she had been drawn to the fact of their waiting because she knew so well that aching experience where time stretched and slowed, where your sense of purpose dissolved and everything was directed toward, when will he return? What if he doesn't return? She told the woman what she was about, and the woman agreed to have her picture taken. Vera started at a distance, maybe 30 feet from the tent. The older girl sat at an angle in the rocking chair, leaning against its back, her head resting in her arms. She looked as if she was daydreaming, and maybe she was. It was a lovely pose, charged with some idea the girl had of herself that was so touching to Vera, which was probably why she had framed the girl out the following shots. It was her instinct to move away from easy sentiment. The mother sat inside the tent with a baby and the two small children. Vera took a picture of the woman as she nursed her child, the skin of her breast, the stretch of it like a pale rise in the landscape. Vera took a few more shots. Then she asked the two little ones to stand on either side of their mother and turn around. Why had she done that? It was not her habit to arrange people. Something about their faces had bothered her. So many children she photographed were uncannily wise, their youthful whimsy snuffed out by hard knowledge, but these two were still open-hearted. And they were so attached to their mother, so certain she would protect them from this stranger with a camera. Their smooth, thoughtful expressions, their mussed hair. Those children made Vera think of her own boys, when they woke from sleep, their wayward locks, their expressions still distracted by dreams. She was abruptly gripped by the certainty that she needed to see Miller and Philip as soon as possible. The feeling descended on her with the full force of an emergency, as if the boys were in distress and she had to get to them immediately. That's right, just turn around, she encouraged, when the children were slow to respond to her request. But even when they faced away, she could still see their innocent expressions. She took the final photograph, packed up the Graflex, and left. Thank you very much. Thank you. So, does anybody have a question off the bat? I can, yes.
So what came first? Do you see the picture and you want to make a story about it and you liked it?
So the question is what came first or what was the inspiration for the book? And I had seen the photograph so many times in my life, as we all have. You know, we've seen it in history books, we've seen it, it's on a stamp, it's, you know, it just appears everywhere whenever the Depression is evoked. Frankly, it's the iconic image of the Depression. But about 4 years ago, I went to a museum exhibit in New York City at the Museum of Modern Art, and there was a photographic exhibition about Western art. And the photograph was included in the exhibit. And again, I saw it, and again, I was drawn to it because it is magnetic. It is hard to not want to look at that photograph. But this time, what compelled me more than the image itself was the curatorial information that was put next to the image. And it said that the woman in the photograph had not revealed her identity until she was old and sick and needed money for her health care. And I found that so moving. I was so kind of blown away by that piece of information that someone who is arguably the subject of, you know, the, one of the most important photographs of the 20th century had never publicly said, "That's me." In fact, in the research that I went on to do, she had a couple of times sort of tiptoed out there into the world to say, "That's me." But there was something particularly poignant to me about the fact that she revealed herself publicly because she needed money, and she was dying, and she wanted money for her health care. So the questions that came up for me were, you know, was she embarrassed by the photograph? Was she disenfranchised by the photograph? Was she angry because she hadn't been paid by the photograph? None of the subjects of those WPA photographs were compensated. And those questions you know, led me into the investigation of that story. And you know, first I began to investigate the real lives of Dorothea Lange, about whom enormous amount is known. There's wonderful biographies about her, scholarly papers. You know, whenever photography is discussed, the history of photography, you know, she's included. And there was much less information about the woman in the photograph, whose name is Florence Owens Thompson. So I investigated those lives, and I began to do the research around those lives, the time and the place. And then, little by little, my sort of imagination stepped in and began to construct the fictional version of that story. I wasn't interested in doing a nonfiction, you know, book about these two women. I was really interested in letting my imagination take it into a fictional realm. I mean, that's what I do. I'm a fiction writer. I'm not a nonfiction writer. So, once I began to invest the characters with interiorities, with feelings and thoughts and, you know, impulses and motivations, they became fictional to me and became Mary Coyne and Vera Dare. Anybody else? Yes.
She worked, all these photographers worked for the Farm Security Administration. They never worked for the WPA.
Right. Thank you. You're correcting me. They did work for the FSA, the Farm Security Administration, not the Works Progress Administration. Thank you.
It always seemed to me, knowing the story of this photograph, you know, one reason her name wasn't, Florence Thompson's name wasn't out there, was because Dorothea could care less. She had her shot. And it was very posed, and in fact, later manipulated in the dark room to eliminate an inconvenient thumb as the lead two start to fall. So there's a certain amount of exploitation involved in doing this. Surely the subject thought, you're from the government, I can't resist having my picture taken, which she represented herself.
Right.
How is what you're doing different than that? I mean, that's the cover. It's very selective in what facts you like. The whole Oklahoma background would be irrelevant to Florence, who was a California native.
No, she actually was from Oklahoma.
Was she?
Yeah. So this is a really great question. This question gets to the heart of a lot of what this book is about, which is about what is the conversation between reality and an artistic rendering of reality. So when Dorothea Lange took her photographs for the government, one of the stipulations actually was that they not take the names of the people because they didn't want to endanger those people. This was a time when people were, you know, banding together and they were striking and then they were being fired if they were agitating. And so part of the government rule book for this project was that they did not want to endanger the people who they were talking to or photographing. So it was actually quite, it was normal and par for the course for her not to have gotten the woman's name. I think the question of how real life is manipulated is central to not only this book, but my preoccupation with writing it, and certainly Dorothea Lange, part of what Dorothea Lange was dealing with as a artist. You know, and it's what I brought up in the reading about, you know, what is the truth? And is it a performance of the truth? My feeling is that the minute somebody brings a camera onto the scene, the truth is altered. You know, we don't all walk around doing our daily activities imagining that we're being observed or imagine that we're being exposed in any way, and certainly not exposed for all time or in perpetuity. So I think that there's a very simply, when somebody says, let me take your picture, even if it's at a birthday party, you have a different, you know, you stiffen up, you fix your hair, you have an idea that you're being seen, and there's something else is going on in that moment that wasn't going on the moment before. So I think just the fact of taking a photograph, whether or not it's posed or not, is an imposition of an artifice on reality. Now, Dorothea Lange did pose those kids, which is quite unusual. She didn't usually pose her subjects, but she had some artistic instinct that, and I don't know what it was. I mean, in my book, with the character, it has to do with her own relationship to her children. You know, I don't know what Dorothea Lange's instinct was that made her do that. I'm sure it was a very subconscious moment for her. She really spent about 15 minutes photographing, and not a lot of information was exchanged. I mean, what was exchanged is documented, and it was, you know, just very scant information. So I think it was just that kind of artistic impulse, that thing that makes something better than something else because she had that gut feeling for whatever reason, and she turned the kids around. And frankly, if you think about what the photograph would have looked like with the kids facing the camera, I don't think it would have been as powerful. I think your focus would have been drawn away from the mother. You would have been engaged in the story of those children's faces. It would have had a whole different set of ramifications. And you can see that from the five other exposures she took that day online. If you look it up, it shows them. And although they're not the same framing, they're certainly not as powerful. The way she framed this, the way she went closer and closer in and cropped them so that the children were almost like squeezed against her. And the frame is so tight that you have this feeling of, you know, there's this almost claustrophobic feeling to the shot. It feels like their life is just that narrowly attached to, you know, happening. So, you know, that's just the genius of her in that moment, of Dorothy Lange in that moment. In terms of my sense of you know, one of the reasons I didn't write about the real people or didn't attempt to write about them was because I personally as a writer wouldn't feel comfortable saying this is what Dorothea Lange thought and felt or this is what Florence Thompson thought and felt. I mean, that's a level of historical fiction that's not comfortable for me as a writer. I mean, many writers do it and do it brilliantly. I mean, if you've read Wolf Hall or any of these things, you know, there can be fantastic versions of just that. But for me as a writer, it was not comfortable for me to sort of assume or presume. And it was much more comfortable to me to be able to sort of take this story and use it as a framework for and on top of which I could layer my imaginative world. Yeah. Yes, the question is about, you know, why the photograph has endured, and it does very much have to do with the fact that she was a brilliant artist, and she had that, you know, that moment, everything that was within her, all her feelings and thoughts about photography and all that she knew and had studied and felt as a human came together in that moment. There's a lot, you know, people talk a lot about why is that photograph so iconic? Why has it stuck in the imagination above and, you know, for many, many years beyond even the Depression? And, you know, there's also something else going on in the photograph, which I find very interesting, which is that it is really a Madonna image. You know, she's carrying her baby. There are these two children. And if you look at a lot of the Renaissance paintings, Mary is carrying a baby and there are these angels at her side. So I think in some ways that image, that structure is embedded in our subconsciouses, you know, in almost like a Jungian way. And so when we see something like that, it brings up a lot of feelings that don't necessarily have to do with that photograph, but that we attribute to our relationship to Mother Mary and that whole story. So the other reason is that the woman in the photograph is beautiful, Florence Thompson. I mean, she has a magnetic face and her expression seems to encapsulate both devastation and endurance. There's something that it's the exact combination of what I think the Depression means to people on so many levels, which is, you know, an incredible sense of devastation and also an incredible will to endure. Anybody? Yes?
So I've read the book. So the male character, and without giving things away, how did you decide, did you play with different things in terms of what his relationship was going to be with the women, or did you kind of know that going in?
The question... Right. The question is about the third main character in the book, whose name is Walker Dodge, who's the contemporary historian. And I knew I wanted to have a third character in the book because I knew I wanted to have both a contemporary character because I felt like the story needed to exist in the present day, not just in the past. And for a reason which I'll describe later. And also I knew that I wanted somebody in the story who was looking backwards, that was sort of... an important, I wasn't sure why at the beginning, but I felt really strongly that I needed someone whose sort of job was retrospection. And then I thought a lot about the baby in her arms. And there was a piece of information that I had read in my research about Florence Thompson, which is terribly unsubstantiated and was only mentioned once, but it sparked my imagination, which was that it said that she had had a child by someone and had to take that child away from that person, that she didn't want that person to take the child away from her. So I don't think that is necessarily true. I'm not sure that happened, but it happened for me in my imagination big time. And so I sort of use that story as well as the story that was beginning to develop about this historian and join those two things together and little by little figured out what the connection between Walker and the photographer and the photograph were. But I didn't know at the beginning. And usually I don't know much at the beginning when I write. In this story, I knew certain things that had to happen because obviously they had to get together. There had to be that moment where the one photographed the other. And there were certain tentpole things that I wanted to land on in terms of things that had actually happened in the life of Dorothea Lange that I thought were really interesting. And the same with Florence Thompson. But beyond that, I generally am kind of groping in the dark. And it's really, you know, little by little trying to figure out the plot aspect. The characters come to me much more obviously than plot. Plot is not my strength. So it's a lot of, you know, running into walls and backing out again and turning a little to the right and running into another wall. But out of those, as frustrating as that is, out of those experiences, you end up figuring out your story. Yeah. Yes. I think she used a number. The question is about what kind of camera she used, Dorothea Lange. She used a number of different kinds of cameras. The one that she took that famous photograph was a Graflex, and I don't remember the exact number of it. So I'm not, you know, I had it all written down in my research, but I'm not a retainer of information that way. But for a long time, she was using Graflex. And then, you know, as time went on, she was using Nikons and all sorts of other, but that was a 4x5 Graflex. And it was very heavy and cumbersome. And so, you know, one of the great stories that Dorothea Lange tells and that I actually used in the book was the first time that she ever took a photograph of real people when she moved out of her studio. And she had to go down with this, you know, incredibly cumbersome Graflex into this crowd of people during the Depression. And, you know, she had this terrible limp. And it was, you know, so you have this image of this, you know, very short woman with this limp kind of hoisting this tripod and Graflex through this crowd of disgruntled people. And, you know, it was quite brave, I think, for her to do that. But I think that was the moment when she became the photographer that we all know her as, when she, you know, had that moment of bravery to do that. Yes.
Do you have sort of a, not a creative writer, like a list of things you want to write about, like sort of in your head, like I want to write about,
You're asking the question that gets to the heart of my the question is, do I have a list of things that I want to write about? If only is the answer to that question. I'm kind of like a one idea at a time person. And what I found is that sometimes I'll be writing and then I'll have this other idea and I'll think, oh my God, I have my next idea. But what I really realize is that that is just part and parcel of what I'm working on. It's I kind of get into a world of themes and people and time and place, and I'm kind of stuck in there until that's over. And then I can move on. I have a bunch of ideas that I want to write for short stories right now that I have sort of just the beginning shreds of. I don't know if they will manifest into short stories, but I'm not the kind of person who has like, oh, I know what my next three novels are going to be. And I envy those people because there's nothing worse than not knowing what's coming next, for me at least. I mean, everybody says, oh, but this is the great time where you're gestating and you're stewing and mulling and it doesn't feel like doing much. I mean, maybe that's what's happening, but oftentimes it feels like I'm just kind of lying on my bed like an idiot. So I would like to have more than one idea. But I've made peace with that part of my process. Yes. Right.
On the cover of your book. That's a very different feel, at least to me.
Yeah. I had very much input. I think mostly, I mean, maybe this isn't true, but I think publishers want authors to be happy with their covers. So I think you get, you know, a fair amount of input. We knew we wanted to use the image for sure. And we played, but I knew really strongly that I didn't want to just use the black and white image. I felt like it didn't suggest that the story was alive and that it had a kind of preciousness to it, and I didn't feel that way about the photograph. I didn't treat the photograph as a precious thing that can't be changed. I changed it. I that's exactly what I did. I wanted the cover to reflect what I did, which was to sort of sample the photograph in musical terms, or to, I don't know what another version of that, appropriate the photograph. And I felt really comfortable about that. That's what I did. And I wanted, so we tried different versions of that image in a way that would suggest that it was changed, that it was appropriated. We tried pixelating it, and we tried, you know, I don't know, all sorts of different things. And what we came up with was cropping it and tinting it. It sort of starts black and white at the bottom and goes into color. And I felt, you know, really strongly. I mean, you know, there were people, of course, who said, how could you change the famous photograph? But I did change the famous photograph in this book. That's what I did. And I also felt like, you know, her life was in color. The photograph was black and white, but she lived in color. And I wanted in the book is about people who are living. It's about life. So I felt like really positively about doing that and suggesting that sort of. The other thing that was really important to me in writing this book was it's a lot of book about history and about how history is what happens when history is translated over time and how it changes and how it gets repurposed and recontextualized and analyzed with more modern values than might have existed at the time. That's certainly what the character Walker Dodge is involved is. He's involved in the understanding of how history changes over time. And that was very much my approach to the book was about how, as a writer, you know, I'm taking this thing that happened and I am changing it. I'm changing the names. I'm changing certain events. I'm appropriating this history, recontextualizing it, reshaping it, and then handing it back again. I'm not saying this is what happened. So I think the cover for me sort of is part and parcel of that whole intention. Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.